This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collett. Welcome to The First Time.
Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Kate.
What's happening this week?
Okay. This week, my publicist, Jane, emailed me about speaking at the Word for Word event in Geelong, which is coming up September.
Nice one.
A bit over 2 months away, but I had to give her my paragraph that will get included in the program and the promotional sort of stuff that will encourage people to turn up. So the whole event goes for an hour, 40 minutes of it is me talking, then there's Q&A, that kind of wraps the whole thing up. Mm-hmm. So I then realised I have to give a 40-minute presentation. I have no idea what to talk about.
You're going to have to get good at this.
Yeah.
Because Kate, you're going to do it numerous times.
What did you talk about? What do you talk about if you have to give a 40-minute?
Yeah, so it depends a little bit on who my audience is. So you do a slightly different one for emerging writers. You do a slightly different one for a reading library crowd. I do a slightly different one to students and a slightly different one to students who've read my book, right? So you pitch it differently. You're doing one for readers.
Yep.
And readers want to know a couple of things. They want the juicy stuff of who you are and how you came to write your book, because as everyone who we've spoken to on this podcast has kind of talked about, this is part of the sale now. You cannot be an anonymous author in the background. You are part of the sale of the book, who Catherine Collett is. So generally, I talk a little bit about how I came to write the book. I always talk a little bit about my aspirations to be a writer when I was young and what kind of went awry for me. And I talk a little bit about failure and rejection, because I think that's a universal and you want to kind of give that story too. And I talk about the historical stuff, because for my book and the readers who are interested, they often want to know about the true story. So the true story has been a real hook for me to talk to people. And often if I have the chance to show things, I'm able to show real pictures of the lighthouse and real pictures of some of the true people behind the story.
So do you do, I'm having the horrible feeling, having written my paragraph, that I've created a lot of work for myself. Do you do themes of the book?
Yeah, you do kind of, because I always talk about friendship, which is a key theme, and it's also a nice segue because I'm able to talk about camping with my best friend when I found the story, the idea of young women's friendship, how friendship isn't always the primary relationship that is shown in books.
Yeah.
And that's an important thing. And I know that readers, I know that readers like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, you put the themes in there too.
So okay, so your themes, you have an innate understanding of the themes of your book, or you've had to get better at
You get better at it. And you get better at realizing what people respond to. So I know where the gags are. Not that there's many when you write a book like mine, but there are some gags and some light moments and some moments where I do the self-deprecating thing. There's moments when I do the slightly inspiring thing and you try and aim for just a little hint of wetness in some people's eyes. You have to have lightness and shade in your presentation. But I did not know that the first time I gave one.
Yeah, okay.
And yeah, it's a whole lot of work when you write it down for the first time.
Yeah.
And then eventually you get to a point. I still take notes every time. I still rewrite parts of my notes every time.
Okay.
But I never pick them up anymore.
Yeah. And Q&A versus talk, or Q&A versus presentation, what would your pick be?
I love Q&A in a panel.
Yeah.
Or being in conversation with someone, because generally you don't feel that need to prepare the structure and the kind of narrative of where the event's going to go.
Yeah.
Having said that, Q&A with an audience is always great. I always encourage that with students. Like, I would prefer to go into a kind of a loose Q&A, especially if they've read the book and studied the book.
Yeah.
But you almost have to have a kind of list down in front of you to make sure you nail some of the things that you want to talk about. And it depends. Like, I'm not very clever at making people necessarily go away wanting to buy my book.
Yeah.
But you get better at that. I think one of the things that you really should do is do a reading.
Yeah.
Because I think
that's a good tip. One
thing that I've noticed
that fills
at festivals.
5 minutes too.
Yeah. And people then say, I've had people say to me, oh, I didn't know what your book was about, or I heard you do the reading in that panel and I had to go and buy it.
Right. Okay. That's a good tip. We had a conversation recently about what makes a panel work and how sometimes you can tell a panel member who's more experienced. And you had some good theories as to what a good panel member will do. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think you want to go onto a panel having done some preparation on the people that you're going to be on the panel with. So you're mostly going to be a guest for this first year. So you want to have read up on the bios of the other people, read their books, if it's at all possible, and know a bit about their stories. Because the best way you can be is authentically interested in the other panelists. Because I think panels work best when there is genuine conversation between the panelists and it's not just the host kind of, you know, going, what do you think on that? What do you think on that? What do you think on that? So knowing enough about the other panelists is a really important aspect. And I think also being aware that there's generally 40 minutes, there's two or three of you, break it down for yourself so that you know, especially if you've been asked to do a reading, you've basically got kind of 8 minutes-ish each. And in that time, you've got to give a taste of your book. You want to, you know, come across with some of the key stuff about it. So you know, like in a job interview, what you've got to get across.
Yeah, that's good. That's helpful. Do you now that your sort of publicity period with Black Ink is over, do you for festivals pitch yourself or are they still pitching you 2 years after publication or are you not going to festivals?
No,
now?
They're not. They wouldn't be pitching me now, but I did get things like I did Brisbane Writers Festival, you know, the year after.
Brisbane then approached you? Is that how that worked?
No, I think Black Ink probably still pitched me for that one. Other things that I've done are through then connections or,
okay,
you know, a library will, you know, have a lot of people reading the book and they'll ask me to be on something or other writers will ask me to be on panels or to speak on things. So it's part, I suppose, of building a network so that you can then continue to pitch those kinds of things.
Which is a useful topic for our subsequent episode on social media.
It is, and we will get into the nitty-gritty of that. Now tell me, you're feeling a little nervous about preparing this big kind of talk.
I just am like, what am I even going to say? But I think you having said that it is a lot of work the first time around kind of puts me at ease. And I've already, I guess what people ask me about now is how did the book come to be? And I have those sorts of stories. What I had pitched was a lot more looking thematically at it. And I suppose I can still do that. So, you know, here's what I pitched.
Tell me.
Okay. So this lighthearted session will look at comedy and satire as forms of social commentary. Catherine Collette will discuss some of the major themes in her novel, The Helpline, including the office kitchen or fridge as a contested space, the role of passive-aggressive notes in the workplace, and the clash between democratic ideals and realities as evidenced by volunteer-run community committees.
No pressure. It's like a friggin' PhD.
I know! Why did I do that? Jane, my publicist, was like, you know, oh, it sounds great. I'd love to come to this. I'm like, yeah, so would I. Don't know if I want to talk.
Yeah, no, I totally want to come to this too. And the thing is that those little stories, you make them little chapters and you write them out because then you like cut and paste them into the next time you have to do something. And eventually those stories have their own beginning, middle and end. They have a climax. They have a resolution. They have all the stuff that we know how to do because we're writers and you get it across.
I'm crossing my fingers, Kate.
What other talks are planned at this stage?
Okay, so I've got a booksellers conference coming up next month. I've got Brisbane Writers Festival and Geelong. So that's current state of play.
Any festivals who are interested in contacting Catherine should do so via her publicist at text.
Jane Watkins. Jane's wonderful.
On this week's episode, we speak to Melanie Cheng on winning awards, what keeps her grounded, and the secret world of short story writers. Today, I have the very great pleasure of welcoming Melbourne author Melanie Cheng to the First Time podcast. Melanie Cheng is a writer and general practitioner. Born in Adelaide, she grew up in Hong Kong and now lives in Melbourne. In 2016, she won the Victorian Premier's Literary Award for an unpublished manuscript. And Australia Day, her debut collection of short stories, went on to win the prize for fiction in the 2018 VPLAs, among many other accolades it has received. Mel was the very first writer we asked to appear on the show, and we are delighted she could join us. Welcome, Mel.
Thank you. I feel very flattered to be the first one to be invited. Thank you.
We're thrilled you're here. Now, your short story collection, Australia Day, was published in 2017 after the VPLA win.
Yes.
And while it was your debut, you've obviously had stories in print before.
Yes.
Can you tell us about the very first one you ever had published?
Well, the very first thing I had published in a literary journal, as opposed to, you know, a medical kind of journal, which doesn't count, was a story I wrote about my grandmother, a nonfiction piece, and that was in Peril magazine, so the online magazine for showcasing Asian Australian writing.
And how did it feel?
Yeah, it was a great, great thrill. I think, you know, it followed months of submitting to various other places. And so it did feel, for me anyway, like a bit of a breakthrough moment. And Leanne Lowe was head of Peril at that time. And, you know, it was just such a thrill to get her email. And, you know, she mentioned that it really resonated with her and reminded her of her own kind of family relationships. And yeah, so, I mean, it was... Yeah, I can't quite describe it. It was just wonderful.
And then after that piece, how many more did you have in print before you began to think you had a collection in Australia Day?
Oh, I mean, the stories in Australia Day, the oldest one is 9 years old. So it was 9 years worth of writing and in that time submitting to journals and competitions. So I don't think it was until very, you know, late in the piece that I, you know, even considered that I had something that could be a manuscript there. I was really content just to have the individual pieces published.
Out there and published. So what made that change? What made you submit to the VPLAs in 2016?
As you get more involved in the writing community, you take notice of other people's journeys. And, you know, I watched, you know, other writers' success through those awards, like people like Graeme Simsion and Maxine Bonoba-Clark. And I guess Maxine in particular, you know, having written a collection of short stories and then achieving great success and acclaim with her collection was, you know, quite an inspiring thing to behold. And I guess that was a bit of a moment for me when I thought, oh, you know, maybe that's something that I could try and do as well. And then that year in the 2016, I saw that, you know, the judges were going to be Jennifer Down and Maxine. And, you know, I thought if ever there's a chance for a short story collection, it might be that year. And so I worked really hard at looking at what I had accumulated over those 9 years and really just seeing if it would work as a collection because I wasn't sure.
And had you conceptualized it at that stage, like Australia Day is in its format now, bookended with the two Australia Day stories?
No, it was quite a different manuscript. Okay. In some ways, I feel a little embarrassed that, you know, people read that original manuscript, which looking back, I feel like it was so raw and, you know, unfinished. And even at the time when I submitted it, you know, I wasn't completely happy with it, but... you always know you have to be in it to win it. So, you know, the deadline approached and I thought, I'm just going to press send. And of course, I'm glad that I did. But, you know, I probably took four stories out, which were a little bit redundant because, you know, some of the kind of themes were very similar to other stories. And then there were flash fiction pieces in there that, again, I was never sure that were really working. And yeah, when I spoke to the editor later, we agreed that they were jarring a bit. For readers. And so I took them out. And yeah, the final story in the collection was actually a new story that didn't feature in the original collection. So I would say about 80% of it was the same, but yeah, a significant 20%, which really kind of finessed and polished the collection, was put in later.
And Mel, you said then, you know, once you're in the writing community, what kind of community of writers did you have around you over that 9 years while you were writing short stories and submitting them to places? Were you doing a course? You're obviously a GP, so you're working.
Yeah.
How did you find that community? Who was in it?
At the very start, there was this creative doctors network that I joined, and that was really inspiring for me at the time because I guess it showed me that you can do both. And for a while, I wasn't sure if it was going to be feasible. And seeing these other people, and they weren't necessarily writers, they were visual artists or photographers or musicians. But it was just great to be around people that were pursuing things other than medicine. So that was That was really crucial point in my, you know, in focusing on the writing and giving myself permission to pursue it. And then later on, I did a few courses whose names I won't name because they weren't great.
Okay.
And then I finally found Writers Victoria, which I think was, again, another crucial moment for me in my writing career. I did a course with Emmett Stinson through Writers Vic, and that's where I met Mark Smith and a few other writers who at the time had published more stories than me. And, you know, I really enjoyed their mentorship and feedback on the stories. And then, yeah, I just kept up my membership with Writers Vic. And of course, through them, you know, met other people. And, you know, they're great in keeping you up to date with comps and things like that.
And there's obviously, there's such a world of short story writers.
That's true.
And who do know about the comps and submit and whose names just come up all the time when you're looking at the kind of competitions that are available. You know, you've said already that feeling of publication. What are the benefits for going in for those comps and all the time, even though there seems to be so many people who do it?
Yeah, I think it's multifactorial. You know, it's great to have a deadline to work towards because, you know, there's this tendency to obviously procrastinate or not even procrastinate, just keep reworking and reworking and never really deciding that it's finished, never pressing send as we discussed before. So it's great from that point of view. You know, I used to love the fact that it was read blind. So it felt very kind of non-threatening, you know, even if someone thought this is terrible, they don't know who you are or so they just throw it to the bottom of the pile. But, you know, it didn't feel really like personal per se. And then, yes, as you say, later on you start to see names and that first shortlisting that you get, which I believe everyone, if you keep at it long enough, will get, is just this amazing validation. And for some reason, it tends to happen when you're at your lowest point and it always just kind of buoys you up and allows you to keep going. So
enough to get back to the writing.
Yeah, yeah.
So the feeling of that, the Unpublished Manuscript Award, so you find out about that. What happens next? How did Australia Day go from being that unpublished manuscript to coming out with text?
Well, that award is just so, you know, a lot of people take notice of it. I don't think I realized until we were shortlisted how much notice the industry takes of that particular award. And I guess that's because of the precedent set by, you know, such successful books like The Rosie Project and, you know, Foreign Soil. Yeah, I distinctly remember I was driving my children to a play date when the phone call from the Wheeler Centre came in. Of course, I pulled over.
Of course.
But at that point, because it was, you know, a week or so out from the official announcement, I had completely discounted myself because my experience with writing comps up until that point had been that, you know pretty far in advance about these things. So, but then when I heard that it was from the Wheeler Centre, I think I decompensated in a way.
And what did they say?
And yeah, so then it was all full on from then, you know, talking about the, you know, the night and the awards night and everything. And then, you know, within, I can't remember exactly now, but it was certainly within half a day of kind of the announcement being made on their website that I was getting emails from publishers asking, can we see it?
And how did you deal with, did you have any advice on how to deal with those emails? Like I can imagine for someone who's been going for short story comps, like this is the dream.
Exactly.
But how do you deal with it?
I know. And in retrospect, I probably, you know, should have dealt with it differently. But, you know, for me, someone asking to read it, I was like, yeah, sure, of course. So I responded very quickly and sent out my manuscript to quite a few publishers. And then, you know, the Wheeler Centre said, oh, you know, Jane Harper has offered to email you guys with some advice because she remembers the experience being quite overwhelming. And I thought, oh, yeah, that sounds fantastic. So I emailed Jane and then she said, don't show anyone your manuscript. And I was thinking, well, oh, wow, that's way too late for that. She was saying, get yourself an agent, you know, keep your cards close to your chest.
Okay.
And then it was all a little bit too late because it was already out there.
But you did go on to find an agent?
I did then go on to find an agent who probably would have preferred that I hadn't sent out the manuscript, but it was done. And so we dealt with it from there. And so thank goodness she was there to then manage the kind of interactions with publishers, because, yeah, I really had no idea what to do at that point. Yeah.
And obviously in the end you went with text. Is text somewhere that you'd imagined your book before? Like, had you done a list or a spreadsheet somewhere of the publishers you would like your debut collection to be
goodness,
published
with? Oh my goodness,
I would
never have, you know.
Been so presumptuous.
Been so presumptuous as to do that. I mean, because my friend Mark Smith had signed with them not long before, I had some sense of what texts were like as a publisher. And I mean, to be honest, as a reader, I never really took much notice of who published books. You know, for me, it was all about the writer and the book itself. So I had heard of the local Melbourne-based publishers, but I really didn't have any insider knowledge. And I guess coming from a background that was so different in medicine, you know, I didn't know people in the industry. I had none of this kind of
inside knowledge.
No, exactly. Yeah.
They've produced a beautiful looking book. Mm. How did you feel about your cover when you saw it?
I think it was a hard cover to do. Because, of course, of the title, and we didn't want to be misleading, you know, with, you know, flags on the cover. You know, you think Pauline Hanson supporters might pick it up expecting something a little different. Perhaps that wouldn't be a bad thing.
Yeah, I was going to say, I do hope that they have picked it up.
I mean, I didn't have a lot of say in the cover, and there was a really long lead time for the cover, and I had a sense that it was hard. So Elizabeth sent me this late one Friday night, I think, and my initial reaction was, oh, that's not quite what I was expecting.
Yeah.
I think I'd seen not long before Rebecca Clarkson's book, Barking Dogs, which had a kind of quite a striking cover of Australian suburbia, and I quite liked that cover, and I kind of thought mine would be along similar lines. So yeah, my initial reaction was, oh, I'm not so sure. But then I slept on it, and, you know, I showed it around to family. And yeah, I can't believe that within such a short time, my feelings towards it changed. And also seeing what Elizabeth had forwarded me from the designer about her thoughts that had gone into it. Because there is a story in the collection called White Sparrow. And in that story, you know, there is a reference to a nest. And because the white sparrow stands out, and the mother sparrow kind of throws the baby out of the nest because they're so conspicuous and easy prey. And so Sandy Cull, the designer, you know, liked that metaphor and image, and also wanted to play on the idea of, you know, obviously the nest as a home, but also the fragility of the nest as a home, and also that it is a home of your own making to some degree. And so once I heard all of those things, you know, I really liked the cover. And the colour is my favourite colour, yellow, and also the last word in the collection is sun, and it's a big feature of the book. And so that was great as well.
It's extraordinary. Once you have that team on board at a publisher's, like the thought that goes into your book, like it can be quite overwhelming. Did you find that with the editing and having so many people involved in producing this?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, I don't think I ever really realized how much work goes into a book until I've been on the other side. I mean, my editor, Elizabeth Cowell, is so thorough. You know, there's a scene in one of the books where I referred to the movie Apocalypse Now. And, you know, I remember getting the edits back and her saying, well, really, that movie is this rating, and would it really be shown at 8:30? And that movie is this many hours and this many minutes long. So when it finishes, it's this time.
So
particular. And, you know, I was thinking, yeah, gosh, you know, and that's what I wanted. But yeah, I felt very sloppy as a writer in not having taken into account all of these things.
That's why we have wonderful editors.
I know, yeah.
Mel, you said that you were unprepared for those kinds of emails that started coming just after the win.
Mm.
Once the book came out, were there other things that you were unprepared for that you hadn't expected?
I think the publicity and the expectations for an author to, you know, do these events. I knew, having had writer friends, that there was that expectation, but I think the reality of it is still quite a shock. And I think the performance element of everything I found very challenging, that as an author, my personality to some degree was part of the package, you know, which is not something that I do as a reader necessarily. I don't associate with an author and then read their books. I think I find books first rather than authors. But I know that in the environment we live in now, people do often find an author they love and then read all of that author's books.
And want to know everything
about
them.
Yeah, want to know everything about them. And so initially I really loved, you know, meeting readers and, you know, hearing from them. Putting myself on show wasn't something that I enjoyed all that much.
Did you find strategies to deal with that and to keep that kind of your other work life and your home life away from the writer life? Like, did you have to divide up your time? Did you keep off social media? How did you deal with that feeling, that unsettling feeling?
Yeah, I think my other job actually was really great. I kept working for most of the time. I think immediately post-launch, I might have had a few weeks off. But because, you know, my work as a GP is very much listening to other people and, you know, putting their stories first and foremost rather than my own, that was a good thing to have as a break away from it.
Very smart.
And also it helps me really keep my perspective on things. You know, if you're going and seeing patients who are suffering real hardships or grief or loss, then it's hard to get too worked up about something silly that you said in an interview a few weeks ago, or not making the shortlist of so-and-so. You know, it just keeps you grounded.
So in an ideal world, would you continue to have your writing life and your practicing medicine alongside each other? Do you think that they will continue to ground each other?
Yeah, I don't think I could give up either, really. Yeah. I mean, I remember before all of this happened, looking to Peter Goldsworthy and thinking that would be great, you know, working part-time as a GP and writing books. And yeah, I feel really fortunate that I've reached that point where I am doing both.
So after the publication, what were the highlights? So we've talked about some of the things that you weren't prepared for. What were the amazing things that happened?
Oh, I mean, I think seeing your book for the first time with the cover and everything was amazing. And seeing your book on a bookshelf at readings in particular, I don't know, because that was my local bookstore, and to walk in and see it on the shelf, that was just a very surreal experience, but a wonderful one. Yeah, and of course, you know, hearing from readers. And I remember at the launch, there was someone, a colleague of my husband's, who came up to me and, you know, was referring to one of the stories and had tears in her eyes. And, you know, to know that it resonated so strongly with someone, I mean, that was really amazing, you know. Yeah.
Why you do it.
Yeah.
Mel, I remembered recently because I was reading a wonderful speech that you've given recently to Year 11 boys that you've got up on your blog about short stories. And it struck me how beautifully written it was. And I was remembering too that I had heard you speak some years back at Bella Union when you were being published in Visible Ink.
Oh, wow.
At that time.
Long time ago.
And, and obviously the way that your book has won awards and been shortlisted for things, you've had to make a lot of speeches. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about this whole process of writing speeches and delivering them. How does it differ for you from writing your short stories? Like, do you sit down to write your speeches out?
Yes, I do sit down to write them, but I do a lot of the writing in my head as I'm kind of doing other things, you know, washing dishes or putting out washing, that kind of thing.
Okay.
I find it much easier than writing anything else, I guess, because it's not usually made up. It's just based on my own experiences. And I do enjoy it. I do enjoy writing the speeches. The delivery, I still get quite nervous before. And so you never really know how it's going to go down. and sometimes it goes better than you expected. And sometimes you think it's going to really hit the mark and it doesn't quite.
And do you take the whole thing with you? Do you have it written out in dot points? Have you memorized it? How do you do your delivery?
It depends a little bit on what it is. If it's just, you know, accepting an award or something and they tell you, you know, keep it short, then, you know, I don't really write anything. Just, you know, remember the important people to thank in my head. But for something like the Emerging Writers Festival speech I had to give the year after the award, I wrote that down. And for the boys' school, I wrote that down pretty much word for word,
Okay, great.
And that actually relieves my anxiety to know that it's there in front of me.
Even if you don't look at it, that you know it's all
there. Yeah, yeah. I think so. For me, it's a kind of, you know, a comfort thing to have it there just in case I have a blank moment.
Have you had any terror stories of blank moments?
Thankfully not yet.
Brilliant.
Yeah. only with the Garrett podcast where he asked me the three books I'd take on a desert island, but thankfully that was edited heavily.
That's always the hardest question. Mel, how do you find, so there's that experience of being able to stand up, know that you're standing up and delivering a speech and then being on panels and various things. How do they differ for you? Do you enjoy one more than the other?
I think I find the delivery of speech, as I said, if it's already pre-written, a little bit easier than necessarily panels, because I know I've heard other writers say they find panels really easy because it's just answering questions. But I mean, if you don't know the questions in advance, I think sometimes you can have a few of those kind of stunned blank moments. And if you speak off the cuff, sometimes you end up saying things that, you know, are not quite what you were trying to say. And yeah, many times I've gone home to a hotel room after a writer's panel and just felt awful about myself.
It's hard too now, because often you can get back to the hotel room and you see it all come up on Twitter, like someone's done it verbatim, right, exactly what you said, so you have to relive the moment afterwards as well.
And there are so many smart, articulate writers out there, and if you get put on a panel with them, you inevitably compare yourself to what they've been doing. You need to, I guess, give yourself a bit of a break and realize that some of these people have been doing this for a very long time.
Yeah, and it's a different set of skills, I think, as well, that you really
exactly
have to learn.
I remember, so one of the first festivals I did was Melbourne, and I was with Tony Birch, who, you know, is,
absolutely. Well,
I looked up to him a lot. And also he's, you know, a professor of writing, and he's used to talking, and he called me Elizabeth for most of the session.
Oh.
And I didn't have the kind of guts to correct him. And then, you know, they do that thing when they ask a question and they hand me the mic first, and I'd talk for maybe 30 seconds, and then they'd hand the mic to Tony and he'd lounge back in his chair and like yarn for 10 minutes. And, you know, I'd ask my mum to come along for support, and at the end I was like, how did I go, Mum? And she's like, I think perhaps it was dominated by the other panel.
So did you take something from that, Mel? Like, have you taken on board then strategies to go, you know what, I'm going to make sure that I get my time, or, you know, what do you think you've got better at?
Definitely I learned from that. You know, I've learned that, you know, people enjoy hearing the stories and kind of, again, it's about giving yourself permission to talk. I guess, again, in my work as a GP, I'm used to listening, and I enjoy listening. I enjoy hearing other people's stories. I find talking about myself a little tedious. I already know, about my own life. But I appreciate that other people want to understand the process that you've gone through to write a book. And I used to sit in the audience eagerly, you know.
Taking notes,
wanting the secret. So I'm trying to, you know, just open up more and relax a bit more about that.
Mel, you're currently working on a new project. How is the experience of trying to work on that while you've got Australia Day and all of its success kind of just there behind you? How are you finding it?
Yeah, it's very difficult. It's partly the time frame, which is relatively short, 12 months after having spent nine years, writing the first book. And yeah, you're not doing it in isolation anymore. You know, there are certain expectations. I guess you develop a certain reputation. And so there is some pressure there that wasn't there before. Definitely. I mean, before it could have always just been a hobby or something, not necessarily a career, which is all wonderful. And then you feel a bit torn, because if you complain about it, then you feel like you're being ungrateful. So, yeah, most of the time I'm this conflicted mess.
As we all are. Mel, is there anything that you wish someone had told you, that you wish another writer had told you before all this, that you think, oh, that's the bit of advice that I needed?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think I've learned this with writing the second book as well. And it's Stephen King's advice that I read a long time ago, which was that you write your initial draft with the door closed and, you know, you rewrite with the door open. Because there's been a lot of pressure to kind of show people early drafts of this second work and talk about it. But I've realized that for me, and I think it's the same for a lot of writers, talking about a work in progress is quite damaging. It can lose its magic for you, because part of the magic is not really knowing what it is and finding that out. And once you start, you know, mentioning it to people, even it could be something as subtle as the kind of, you know, raise an eyebrow or something. And
people
then you
don't realize what they do with
and then
faces.
You think, oh, no, yeah, that's clearly a ridiculous scenario or idea. And so I think I've grown a bit stronger about, you know, setting boundaries and not showing things until I'm quite ready. But that's taken time for me to realize. So perhaps if I'd been given that advice early on,
it might not have even worked for you at that point.
Yeah.
Mel, do you have a debut book that you can recommend to us? One that's an old book or one that's out now?
Well, I've been reading a lot for, you know, festivals, fellow panelists and things. And a couple that I've come across that I've really enjoyed recently was No More Boats by Felicity Castagna.
Yes.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. I think she touched on the migrant experience in a really beautiful and unique way. And I did a panel in Adelaide with Rebecca Clarkson, who wrote Barking Dogs, who I referred to earlier because I loved her cover. I had cover envy. And, you know, that book's really wonderful portrait of the kind of those new suburban, you know, developments in South Australia. And yeah, she just also writes really beautifully.
Excellent. Two good recommendations for us. Thank you. And I suppose you've given us some advice already, but if there's anything specifically that you can think for Catherine's about to leap into her book being published in September, what's a piece of advice she can take with her for this new part that she's about to embark on?
I guess for me, I was a bit prone to the imposter syndrome. So that happened after the prize and also, yeah, soon after kind of publication. And I don't know if that was also because I have no background in the arts in terms of my study and qualifications. But that was really unhelpful thing, you know, along the way. And I'm slowly learning to just own it, you know, a bit more and allow myself to enjoy it rather than second guess, you know, the good stuff. And so you can do that and still say to stay true to yourself and stay grounded, I think. And so that would be my advice.
Mel, thank you so much for sharing and opening up with us. Thank you for joining the First Time Podcast.
No worries. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so we're with Mel Cheng for the First Time Quick Five. Mel, for your first time, agented or unagented?
Agented.
Advance or no advance?
Advance.
Overseas territory sold or just Australia, New Zealand?
No, just Australia, New Zealand.
Just Australia, New Zealand. Festival invites or no festival invites?
Festival invites.
And absolutely you can pass and people don't know this. Do you know how many copies you sold?
I don't know. I don't ask.
I know lots of people
I deliberately
have said,
don't
I
ask.
Deliberately don't want to know. Thank you so much, Mel.
For more information on Melanie Cheng or any of the things we talked about on today's episode, check out the show notes on our website or get in touch via Twitter or Instagram.
You've been listening to the First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe Adie and Harry Morris. The First Time Podcast is created with the support of Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre, and RMIT School of Media and Communication.